Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps, and my pronouns are she and hers. And I'm telling you that because navigating personal pronouns these days is trickier than it used to be. Our culture is becoming more inclusive, which is a really great thing. But we are also becoming more cautious about speech and quicker to take offense at other people's words. So in this episode of To the Best of Our Knowledge, what happens when we start filtering free speech? Stay tuned.
Wisconsin Public Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Have you ever gotten in trouble for something you said? An opinion, an expression, even a word? Have you ever encountered the speech police?
I was in a writer's room for a few weeks in Los Angeles, a television writer's room, a show on one of the big networks.
This is Walter Mosley, the famous crime writer, and he's about to tell a story about a word, an extremely offensive word with a brutal history that we all struggle with. It's the N-word. And frankly, we really wrestled with whether or not to even use it in this show, but we can't tell the story without it. So if you don't want to hear it, this is the time to turn away and rejoin us in 10 minutes.
One day I get a call, been there about 3 weeks, I get a call, and a young guy, nice-sounding young guy, said to me, Mr. Mosley, we hear that you used the N-word in the writer's room. And I said, well, you know, I am the N-word in the writer's room. And he said, well, you know, you can't say that word. What do you mean? I said, well, you can't say it. If you want to write it in a script, that's fine. You can't utter it. Now, the reason he was calling me was because a few days before, we were all talking about experiences with the police, and I was talking about at one point in Los Angeles, I'd been walking down Robertson Boulevard and a policeman stopped me. He searched my pockets, he asked me questions, he searched me again, he asked me some more questions, he repeated the questions. And then finally he said, okay, you can go. And I said, excuse me, officer, could I ask you a question? And he said, well, yeah, sure, what? Why did you stop me? I didn't do anything, I was just walking down the street. And you stopped me and you searched me and you questioned me, I wonder why. And he says, listen, when I see a nigger in a Patty neighborhood, I stop him. And when I see a Patty in a nigger neighborhood, I stop him because they're almost always up to no good. I told that story. And HR called me and they said, you can't tell that story? It wasn't like I was insulting somebody, harassing somebody, threatening somebody. All I did was tell a story that happened to me. So I quit the writer's room. I went away and I thought about it for a while and I wrote an op-ed piece for the Times explaining how I quit the writer's room, why I quit the writer's room, and why I felt that it was an attack on both my freedom of speech and also my right to pursue happiness.
Okay, so this is tricky. There's free speech, but there's also offensive speech. Words that aren't illegal, but that, rightly, carry steep social penalties, like being called out, or canceled, or that phone call from HR. This kind of thing comes up all the time these days, in schools, workplaces, online. And our question in this episode, when is it sensitivity and when is it censorship? So let's hear Walter Mosley's story. Here's Charles Monroe Kane.
Walter, when you got that phone call, you personally, like, how did you feel?
Well, you know, it was kind of surprising to, you know, hear somebody who I think probably was a white person, who I know definitely represented an institution run by white men mainly, calling up a black man and telling him that he can't refer to the language that suppressed him and his for four centuries. I thought, wow, that's crazy. And then as I thought about it more, I said, well, you know, this is attack against everybody. It's not just me. It's attack against the freedom of speech. All of a sudden, there's somebody in an office somewhere who can say, if you say something we don't like, we can fire you.
I mean, it was just a warning, right? They were going to ask you to apologize or anything.
But you know how HR works, right?
Oh, yeah.
You say one time, then something else happens, and then something else happens. You know, you have to say, well, we're thinking about getting rid of this person, so we have to start working on it.
Yeah, they're building the paperwork to get you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, you have to listen. They can't just fire you like that. They have to call me. They have to talk to me about it in order to fire me. Now, listen, they might not have ever fired me, but I can't work in a writer's room where people are so sensitive that if I say something, just explaining an experience, that they're going to snitch on me. So, like, the idea was is that I couldn't work in the room anymore anyway.
Right, right, of course.
My freedom of expression was gone. And believe me, I don't just think this is true in writer's room. I think that anywhere, if somebody's talking, telling a story, responding to stimulus in the world around them, I think all of that, we have to at least consider the freedom of expression. Does me being uncomfortable means you lose your constitutional rights? That's an important question. I felt uncomfortable.
Right. You know, the word uncomfortable is a big question here. What happened to that person? I would assume they would say they were offended. But really what they were is they were uncomfortable that a black man said the N-word and they were uncomfortable. That's like a safe space. You know, I work on a college campus and there's so much trigger warning talk and safe spaces. And it's like you invaded their safe space, man. You triggered them. You triggered them, Walter.
Now, listen, I understand that. I don't even argue with that kind of language or that thought. But I know what the Constitution says. I can't yell fire in a crowded theater. I can't use language to attack, bully, or harass a person. I understand that. But that doesn't mean I can't use language.
Right.
And language is open to everybody. That's part of being an American, a big part of being an American.
You've been around a while. What happened? I mean, that wouldn't have happened 40 years ago. What happened?
I don't know. I really don't understand. But, you know, like 40 years ago, if you were in a writer's room, there were all white men in that writer's room. You
right,
know, and this is
sure.
Different. You know, today there's women, there are people of color. There are a lot of people in the room. I don't know who said this to me. There are other people of color in the room. Maybe it was one of them. I don't know. Listen, there are a lot of really bad things that have come up in the last few years.
Right.
Sexual harassment, rape, all kinds of really awful stuff. And that stuff needs to be taken care of. No question. But that doesn't mean that every possible thing that I can say has to be under the scrutiny, under a very McCarthyistic-like organization that calls up and says, someone has said that you have done this. And the guy who called me, he said, the person who called me told me that they didn't want to get you in trouble. And I said, excuse me, but the fact that you're calling me means I'm in trouble, right? And he went, well, yeah, it does.
Wow.
I said, so forget that they didn't want to get me in trouble. They did. And now I have to deal with you, which I don't like.
Right.
He honestly said, if you used the C word, I would fire you immediately.
He said that directly on the phone to you?
Uh-huh.
What I don't understand is context. I mean, what if you're writing on the show and the C word is a part of what is happening? Maybe the C word, you're showing it that is wrong inside the show, and that's the way you want to go as writers, right? Or a character uses it.
Oh, no, I could write it in the script.
You just can't say it. So would you have to stand up and say C word in a meeting?
Yeah, exactly. Which, by the by, is worse than the word. N word is worse than nigger. I mean, like the idea that you, because N word makes it acceptable.
Yeah.
It's never going to be acceptable to say, well, that nigger did this. But he said, well, you know, the N-word, you know, I'm like, well, that sounds okay, actually. And I don't want it to sound okay. That's why I use the real word, not the hyphenate word. And of course, a lot of black people will argue and they say, but what if a white person said it? And I said, well, you know, listen, if they said it trying to attack or insult or harass me, that's a problem. But if they said it the way I just said it, I can't get on them. I live in America. So well, would you like that? And I said, well, no, I wouldn't like it. But, you know, there are certain things you have to accept in America.
Why does that make you feel? As an artist, I mean, how does that make you feel?
I was upset when the person was talking to me on the phone. But later, after I quit and I realized, wow, that's okay that I quit, that I felt good being able to have that conversation. Because what's most important is that we discuss who and what we are. It's the absolute opposite of human resources. We actually sit and discuss something. Then, yeah, I'm going to learn something, right? Mm-hmm.
You're right, exactly.
But this is not about learning something. This is about obey me, Joseph McCarthy says, or you're going to go into jail, you're going to lose your job, you're going to be out the country. I'm like, wow. And you feel you can just say this to me, do this to me. And it's okay, because those are the rules. You know, this is Hannah Arendt talking about the banality of evil.
You know what scares me more than anything is the guy after you. Now, he comes in, doesn't matter what race or woman who comes in after you, mm-hmm. who knows the story of what happened to you, because, you know, everybody knows what happened, right? And they come in and they pre-censor, right? They come in and say, I'm going to censor myself. Here's what I'm going to do. But you are mm-hmm. making art, right? With words. And so as writers, if everyone starts censoring themselves for a politically correct culture, then it diminishes the art.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And listen, all writers' rooms are not like this, but almost all HR rooms are like this.
Mm-hmm.
All you need is one person to say, I felt uncomfortable. I didn't feel safe. And listen, I'm not saying that that's invalid. I think that that's always true. But how one deals with it becomes the issue.
I want art to push me. I want it to actually make me. I want to be made uncomfortable. Isn't that the point of good art, of good films, of good TV? I mean, it's to push us so that we can grow as a culture. I don't think that's happening right now because people are afraid to even write it.
And listen, you don't want to get back to the place in the 1960s and 70s and 80s when all the people in a writer's room were white men. You don't want to get to that place.
No, no.
But the room I was sitting in, there were four women in the room. There were three black people in the room. There was an Asian woman. I mean, there was a Native American woman. I mean, it was all over the place. That is what we need.
Yes.
We need people to represent. But at the same time, even if you feel uncomfortable, there's a lot of times I feel uncomfortable with things that people say. But I have to deal with it. I have to learn how to deal with it, either through discussion or just dealing with myself. Somebody had said to me a while ago, we should outlaw the Confederate flag. And I said, absolutely not. This is America. We have freedom of expression. And not only that, if somebody has an American flag in their heart, I don't mind seeing it on their forehead, too. It's okay. And that's an important thing for me. I'm not sitting around arguing that only black people have the right to control a certain arena of language. We all have to deal with language. We all have to deal with discomfort. We all have to learn from that and hopefully get better in dealing with each other.
It seems that there needs to be a point where we have to let this go for a moment and let the right-wing guy speak on your college campus.
Oh, well, I listen. Everybody has, it's freedom of speech. I mean, this is like America. You can't sit around and like silence people. That doesn't get rid of it. It just expresses your anger, but it doesn't get rid of whatever the problem you imagine is. I remember when I was in a high school, we used to have speakers. And one week, James Baldwin came, you know, and that was great.
Wow, holy crap.
And the next week, the same initials, the John Birch Society came.
Whoa.
And they told their story. You know, we just went and listened. I mean, I thought the John Birch Society were idiots, but that doesn't matter. There's no other way to actually work out stuff. You know, a democratic politics has to have an open forum. I have a right to say stuff. You have a right to say stuff.
Walter Mosley is a crime fiction writer, author of the famous Easy Rollins series, and the writer's room he quit was for Star Trek Discovery. He talked with Charles Monroe Kane. So, what is happening with free speech on college campuses these days? We'll take you there. Next, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. College campuses and free speech debates go together like diapers on a baby. Remember the free speech movement? Berkeley, California, 1964.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious.
The first mass act of civil disobedience on a college campus.
You've got to put your bodies upon the gears and you've got to make it stop.
It went on for months. Thousands of students protesting the university's ban on political activities and demanding academic freedom. Well, today, college students on the left are demanding the opposite, protection from words and ideas they consider harmful. Jonathan Haidt, a social psychologist at NYU, worries that the end result will be a generation that does not know how to have real debates or constructive arguments.
The speaker shoutdowns are the most dramatic examples, and it's in part because they're always captured by 20 or 100 cell phones. Many listeners will be familiar with the really big cases. It was Milo Yiannopoulos at Berkeley, Charles Murray at Middlebury, but there are dozens of these. So another example is Heather McDonald, a conservative, was speaking at Claremont McKenna College. Some students organized over Facebook. They organized the idea that she should not be allowed to speak, that they were going to shut it down. They ringed the auditorium. They didn't let anyone in. They pounded on the glass. She had to be brought in and out with police escort. So these things are the most dramatic. But where it really begins to affect people is the sort of the more everyday interactions. That's where you really find the chilling of speech, in my opinion.
What do you mean, everyday interactions?
Yeah, so what really emerged in 2014, 2015 is a new attitude towards speech, a new policing of speech, a new concern about speech. And so if you look at a lot of these really dramatic examples on campus, they tend to be about a tweet or an email or a single word. So one of them was also at Claremont McKenna in Los Angeles. A dean, Mary Spellman, had written to a student who had posted an essay very critical of Claremont McKenna. She was of Mexican descent, and she wrote about how she felt marginalized, didn't feel that she belonged, didn't feel that she fit in. And a dean wrote her a private email, very nice. We've got the quote of the whole email in our book. And at one point she said, "We're very concerned about students who don't feel that they fit our CMC mold." But the student didn't like the use of the word mold, posted it on her Facebook page, invited everyone to share it, and there was an explosion on campus. Students demanded that the dean be fired. Students went on hunger strike saying they would not eat until she was fired.
What specifically was the objection with the word mold?
So if you take it in the worst possible way, you could say, as the student did, she's basically said, oh, she's saying I don't fit the mold, I don't belong. And of course, if the dean of students was writing to you a private email saying, you don't belong, get out, well, that would be a crime. That would be horrible. But what she was doing was the opposite. What we're seeing is a change in which students are looking to take offense. I don't want to be too hard on them. There's a lot of reasons why this culture has emerged. But what we're seeing is a change in the sources of prestige. And what came about, in part because of social media, is an economy of prestige in which you get credit for calling someone else out. And so that's what this student had done to Dean Spellman. Dean Spellman meant no harm. She was trying to be helpful. But a student was able to get prestige by basically labeling her a racist.
Do you know that she was trying to get prestige doing this? I mean, maybe she really was bothered by this.
Oh, well, she might have been bothered by it. But prior to 2014, the normal rules of social interaction are that we judge people largely by their intent and or by what a reasonable person would make of something. And those are the rules that have governed universities for a long time. So I've been teaching since 1995. When I taught at the University of Virginia, I often tried to be provocative. We trace our ancestry back to Socrates, and Socrates developed a way of being a gadfly of the Athenian people, of provoking reactions. And my students trusted me. I trusted them. I would teach a 75-minute course, an introductory psychology lecture, and take them on what was sort of an intellectual and emotional roller coaster. And I would try to elicit emotion, and I'd make sure everything wrapped up in the end. And so that's what I used to do in my teaching. But since 2014, 2015, the standard has shifted. In fact, one of the new ideas on campus is that it's not intent that matters, it's impact. This causes a lot of problems because if you're teaching to a class of 300 people, now you're responsible. If any one student takes offense, they have been impacted and you are guilty.
But it's fascinating also what you're saying. I mean, you're saying something happened around 2014, 2015, and as a new generation of students started coming onto college campuses and the rules had changed.
That's right. It is something new. It really did seem to appear overnight. And then things got much worse on campus after 2015. What's changed is that for kids born after 1995, they are not millennials. It's called iGen.
The internet generation.
That's right. It was the 90s when American parents basically got it into their heads that if they ever took their eyes off their kids, if the kids were outside and there was not an adult watching them, they would be abducted. There's data showing that play, unsupervised outdoor play, declined. Kids moved inside under supervision, more supervised activities in the afternoons. So for a lot of reasons, childhood changed in the 90s and early 2000s.
So to bring this story back to what's happening on college campuses then, one way to interpret this is these students are a lot more fragile than previous students. They have all these high rates of anxiety, of depression. Maybe they do need to have these safe zones on campuses because they can't handle it otherwise.
So it is certainly true that there are many more people who have depression and anxiety issues. And I think it might be legitimate to say that they are more fragile in that sense. But what does that imply? So if we have overprotected kids all the way up through college, what should we do? Well, obviously, we should continue overprotecting them for 4 more years. No, no, exactly the opposite.
Should certain people not be allowed to speak on campus? Now, I'm thinking of someone like Milo Yiannopoulos, Trump supporter, former editor at Breitbart, who, as far as I can tell, is basically a provocateur. I mean, he says outrageous things and sort of with the intent to goad other people. And I think he actually wants to get kicked off of campus because then he can say, look at the left-wing fascists who are shutting down free speech. Should he be allowed on campus?
Basically, he calls himself a troll. This is his modus operandi. This was his mission. He's using the extremity of certain campus factions against them. So I am not a, quote, free speech extremist or whatever the word is. I'm a professor on a college campus. I think what we're trying to do on a college campus is something very special, which is we're trying to create a community in which people come face to face with ideas that they didn't know, are not familiar, may even challenge or threaten beliefs they hold dear. So if someone comes, if a researcher comes and says, I have research showing that, you know, inequality is not rising or that it has some good effects or whatever. If somebody comes with research that challenges cherished notions, that's the most important kind of person to have speak. But if somebody's there to provoke a reaction, no, I don't think there's any particular value if they're not there to share ideas.
Yeah. What's your larger fear here about what's happening? And you know, we've been focusing on college campuses in particular. Is it that we're creating the conditions where these young people will lead lives that will lead to more depression, more anxiety? Or is it from a political perspective, this is all bad for democracy because people are not being exposed to other viewpoints? What are you especially worried about?
I think you put your two fingers on the big two. So let's put it this way. Each institution has a purpose. There's a game that you play in each institution. And in universities, it should be the truth-seeking game. In our scholarship, in our classes, we're doing special things, unusual things, with the goal of figuring out what's true. And because we're all so biased and so good at post-hoc reasoning, we can't actually do that on our own. We need other people, and we need diversity of ideas and opinions to do that. But there's another game, which is the politics game, or the war game, or the combat game, which is it's us versus them, and we're going to do everything we can to win. We're going to play with language to give ourselves an advantage. We're going to extend concepts to change the rhetorical battlefield so that we can win more easily. And when that game gets brought onto campus, it makes it very difficult to do the truth-seeking game. So I think the new morality that we're seeing on campus, in which students are fragile, the world around them is threatening and dangerous, they must be protected, it's very bad for the students. It's bad for their habits of discourse. And when they're hired in companies, it now seems, at least in tech, media, and we're beginning to see it in law, these are some of the areas that I'm hearing from people. If they bring this more combative attitude into the workplace, it makes it very hard for those institutions or companies to function too.
Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist at NYU. Steve was talking with him about the book he wrote with Greg Lukianoff, The Coddling of the American Mind. The idea that universities are crushing free speech is a popular talking point for conservative critics and Republican politicians. But things aren't always what they seem. Sometimes, complaining about the so-called speech police amounts to giving tacit approval to hate speech. Take the Middle Ages. When I think about medieval history, this is what I hear in my head. Definitely not this. That's audio from the deadly white supremacist rally in Charlottesville in 2017. And some of those people carrying Nazi and Confederate flags were also in medieval costume, with crusader crosses and shields with medieval insignias on them. White nationalists are fanboys for the Middle Ages? Well, a few weeks after that rally, feminist medievalist Dorothy Kim, who's now a professor at Brandeis, wrote an open letter to her colleagues, exhorting them to speak out against white supremacy. Then the alt-right got wind of her piece. She got hate mail, threats of violence. She had to request security guards for her lectures. Now her profession is in an uproar, and her personal life is upended. Let's go back and talk about where this all began for you. The summer of 2017, I think this was maybe about 10 days after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville.
Yes.
You wrote a blog post titled Teaching Medieval Studies in a Time of White Supremacy.
Yes.
What sparked that? What was going on that made you want to write that?
I basically had been watching online all the things that had happened at Charlottesville. All that sort of Viking, Black Sun, Old Norse imagery. Figures like Matt Heimbach talking back and forth about how you're supposed to look at the rally. Bring these shields and not those shields. Dress like this, but not like this. We don't want to look like we're at some random cosplay event. We want to have a very specific visual rhetoric.
I guess I think probably a lot of people would be surprised that white nationalists and white supremacists are fans of the Middle Ages? What is it about the Middle Ages that appeals to them?
Well, it depends. So the alt-right or the far-right is a sort of complex ecosystem, and they have different nodes in that ecosystem. So you have, for instance, the Sons of Vinland, the Wolves of Vinland in the Pacific Northwest, and they're interested in the Vikings and sort of imagining a pre-modern warrior past, and obviously the Sons and Wolves of Vinland have been deeply violent in the Pacific Northwest. They are often the instigators in these really terrible white supremacist marches and rallies in Portland, for example, and also obviously have murdered people. One of the interesting things I've been trying to think through and work out is why the Middle Ages is so important to so many parts of that alt-right ecosystem, far-right ecosystem, but also why is it so easy to co-opt it? It's about fields not wanting to deal with their own academic histories in propping up sort of global colonialism and also narratives of white supremacy.
This isn't new. Medieval studies has
been
complicit with white supremacy in the past.
Yeah, so I wrote a piece for Time last year where I talked about the Vikings. And I talked about the fact that the Vikings academically have a long history where basically people in the 19th and even the 18th century used it as a way to prop up like white superiority and fascism. This has a history, right? Similarly, there is current upheaval in another area of medieval studies right now, and this is Anglo-Saxon studies, with also similar histories at stake and with a lot of co-option by white supremacists interested in that area and topic. It's embedded in the scholarship. It mostly has to do with upholding white global empire is in fact superior to the rest of the world.
So you wound up writing this blog post warning other medievalists that your field was being weaponized, as you put it, by hate groups.
Yes.
And you basically said, if you teach the Middle Ages, you can't ignore this.
Yes.
You have to say something. What? What did you want your colleagues to do?
I think I want them to be really overt about how they frame the Middle Ages. I want them to be overt about not discussing these sort of fantasies of whiteness in relationship to the pre-modern past. If you walk into a classroom and you're teaching the Vikings, I don't think you can just say, oh, aren't they great? And then just sort of move along, if that makes sense.
You actually, in that piece you wrote, you used the analogy of weapons dealing.
Yes.
To describe the role medievalists have in the classroom today, which is kind of incendiary language. What did you mean?
I think because if we are not sort of critical about what is going on and how our fields or these histories are being weaponized, they do become ideological weapons. And I think we see this with the number of white terrorists who have constantly used various medieval sort of references or cues in their various manifestos or on their various weapons when they have gone into Black, Indigenous, people of color communities in order to kill people. Every time there's a really terrible white male shooter, I look through various manifestos and things, and there's always some sort of medieval reference.
Really?
Yes.
Like what?
New Zealand. He used multiple medieval references. He used the Vikings. He also talked about Crusader things. So there was like a whole little list. This keeps popping up as part of white shooter supremacist manifestos.
Well, speaking of violence, after you wrote that post to your fellow medievalists, you wound up getting targeted yourself by the
Yes.
alt-right. What exactly happened?
Basically, a University of Chicago medieval history professor decided to write a blog hit piece on me. She tagged Milo, and then Milo wrote...
This is Milo Yiannopoulos?
Yes. Milo Yiannopoulos wrote another piece about me and sort of sent it out to his 2.3 million followers. After that, also, obviously, I became a target.
Were you getting death threats?
I did get violent threats, yes.
My God, how do you deal with that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think, you know, obviously it's good to have mental health counseling. It's unfortunate, but we live in a world right now where these things happen, particularly in relationship to minority, Black, Indigenous, women of color voices. It's a thing that has been happening for a while.
So I imagine that you have thought a lot since then about the larger context, the debates about free speech that we're having these days, and not only on college campuses. And I wonder how you're thinking about free speech has evolved in light of all this.
What I see, sort of this idea that there's some sort of free speech crisis, is actually, it's a red herring. It's basically a way for the far right to infiltrate various discussions and use various terminologies in order to get some sort of outrage reaction. It's not actually about free speech.
What is it about?
It is about getting people to panic. It's like a panic button.
You're saying it's a dog whistle.
It's a dog whistle. I think it's very interesting in relationship to academia that the kind of red herring of free speech is used, and it's sort of framed out that all these much more conservative academics are being attacked and terrible things are happening to them. But the statistics show that actually the people who are being fired and are losing money and also safety are actually the ones with less power because they are Black, Indigenous, people of color, they're transgender scholars, and I think people are not dealing with that. And what's going on now is for a lot of historians who are working or have worked on fascist ideology, it must feel like deja vu.
Dorothy Kim is a medievalist at Brandeis University. Okay, so let's say after doing that interview, I decide to post a comment about it on Twitter. I should, actually. Our digital director would be absolutely thrilled if I tweeted pretty much anything. I don't. Because frankly, Twitter scares me. You say one wrong thing, make one ill-considered remark, and people are all over you. Like hyenas on a buffalo carcass. They rip you, shame you, cancel you. Well, journalist Alyssa Quart shares my fear. She even wrote a poem about it.
I was reading these tweets, some of them actually by young feminists and sometimes just by trolls, attacking certain second wave feminists online. Elaine Showalter and Katha Pollitt, and I was so upset. And there's all these young feminists being like, oh, you know, cancel her, old cow. And at the time, I was also reading Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey, and I was thinking this is a postmodern version in some ways of the ways that mothers can be thrown aside from the dawn of time. Cancel this. On Twitter today, they say, cancel this.
Cancel that.
Cancel the second wave feminists.
Cancel ancient Sumer, the Euphrates, the well-oiled feet of Telemachus.
The platform then cries,
apologize, apologize.
How to not be called out on Twitter,
YouTube, the gram.
Make up tutorials, adopt a single name.
Worry strictly about your algorithm.
Order food good enough to look at, but not to eat. Cancel civilization.
Or maybe not.
Cancel canceling.
The Greeks.
Listen to Athena. Girl, your symbolic mothers still circle around the island.
Hopefully with their lovers, while the fathers are with Circe and co.
Women's minds are wild.
Protect their honor.
It is yours as well. So I was inspired to write that by this, but I do think that there's something about this kind of public shaming based on nothing, based on no history. In fact, against the history of the person. Like if you're attacking these second wave feminists online, you're sort of forgetting about the 40 years of work they did before the one thing that offended you or whatever. It's kind of nihilistic. And it doesn't think about facets of people. That scares me.
Me too. Alyssa Quart's new book of poems is called Thoughts and Prayers. She's a journalist and executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Coming up, remembering the dark history of censorship in America and the people it hurt. That's next on To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. There's a word that's been popping up a lot lately, including earlier in this episode, McCarthyism. One word that sums up an entire period of American history. The Red Scare, the blacklists, secret FBI files, government informers, loyalty oaths, public hearings, and at the center of it all, Joseph McCarthy. But are there really parallels today to the censorship and the fear that dominated America during that period? To find out, journalist and historian David Marinus decided to dig up his own family history when his father, also a journalist, was blacklisted.
Good evening. This is Joe Hainline of the WJR News staff about to present in the public interest a transcribed program of the House Un-American Activities Committee into the extent of communist influence in Michigan.
I knew that my father had written a statement because the transcript of the hearing was a matter of public record since the 1950s.
Are you ready now to go forward?
Yes, sir.
The chairman of the committee, John Stevens Wood of Georgia.
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Said that he could not read the statement.
Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
He could submit it to the committee, and it was submitted and buried for 60-some years until I was at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. All of the files of the House Un-American Activities Committee had been opened.
I want to express it again that I feel that anyone who takes up the cudgels of the Communist Party...
There was a file on these hearings in Detroit.
...is in effect wielding a bayonet as efficiently as a communist soldier in Korea.
And within those files was a folder, a typewritten statement on an old typewriter, Elliot Marinus. In the 34 years of my life in War and Peace, I've been a loyal, law-abiding citizen of the United States. I've been summarily discharged from my job. I have been blacklisted in the newspaper business after 12 years. I must sell my home, uproot my family, but I would rather have my children miss a meal or two now than have them grow up in the gruesome, fear-ridden future for America projected by the members of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. It was really then, for the first time in my life, that I could feel my father going through that experience.
David Marinus is the author of A Good American Family, The Red Scare, and My Father. Here he is talking with Shannon Henry Kleiber.
So I'm really curious to know more about growing up, how much you knew about what was happening with your dad and the Red Scare, and did he ever talk much about it? And do you remember when you first heard the word blacklisted? And were you like, what is that?
You know, my father would talk about being fired by the Detroit Times, which he was immediately after the subpoena was served on him in 1952. I didn't know about it at the time. I was not yet three. I knew that we moved around a lot when I was a boy. From 1952 to 1957, we moved to New York, to Ann Arbor, to Detroit, to Cleveland, to Detroit, to Bettendorf, Iowa, to Madison, finally, in 1957, when the Capital Times in Madison hired my father. And in essence, my family was saved. From that point on, my father was just looking forward. He had survived. He had not given up his principles. Many former communists became staunch neoconservative, anti-communists, or disillusioned, depressed people. And my father was neither. He was a very optimistic person who rose at the Capital Times from reporter to editor to editor-in-chief of the paper over the next 25 years. He did not look back. I never thought about it. Occasionally, you know, he would talk about how he didn't like McCarthy or Richard Nixon, who had also been on the House Un-American Activities Committee and made his name fighting communists or pinkos in the United States. But it was not a subject that he wanted to delve into with any depth. There was one point in the 1990s when I was making a pathetic attempt to write a novel, and I interviewed my father for a few hours, and he really didn't want to go there. Mm. So he would talk about everything around it, but he was not comfortable talking about the specifics of his time in the Communist Party or when he was fired. He would talk about everything else but that.
What was surprising to you about your father? Did you ever have a moment when you thought, oh, that's why he thought that, or I didn't know that about him?
You know, my father was the commander of an all-black unit in World War II. I knew that. He would talk about parts of that, but not in any depth. He was more likely to talk about going through a typhoon on the way to the Pacific or playing poker in the hold of the ship. I knew that my mother had letters that he had written from World War II, and I looked at them, and they were all about that period when my father was forming that unit. And the measure of pride that he had in developing a company of men who were fighting ostensibly for liberty and democracy for a nation that was still treating them as second-class citizens and discriminating against them and segregating them in the American Army. And there's one letter he wrote where he sort of says, He has writing in his blood, and he loves every part of newspapers, from the writing to the editing to the layout. That's why he writes. And that's what I've always said. To see him articulate it in the exact same way was very powerful to me.
It felt familiar, probably.
Yeah. And so this history was deep in my blood, and I didn't even sort of feel it consciously. It was all subconscious.
Well, you learned more about yourself through it. It sounds almost cathartic, was it?
It was. You're absolutely right, Shannon. I did learn more about myself. I set out to learn about my parents, and in the end, I did, but I also learned much about myself and why I am the way I am and the effect that my parents had on that.
You focus also on these people who are obsessed with rooting out communists. For instance, the woman who denounced your dad, this grandmother who moonlighted as an FBI informant. She's such an interesting character. How much about her did you find out? And did you think about going to her family members and saying, your grandmother ruined my father's career? Or did you want to kind of move that story ahead? Or?
Well, that's a great question, because I did find her grandchildren living in suburban Detroit. Her name was Berenice Baldwin. She was a 49-year-old grandmother at the time of the hearings, who had been recruited 9 years earlier by the FBI to infiltrate the Communist Party in Michigan, rose through the ranks to become the secretary of the party, had hundreds of names in her files of people who belonged to the party at various points. One of those names was my father's. And she came in from the cold, so to speak, at those hearings. The first time anybody knew that she had been an infiltrator, an informant for the FBI, the grandmother spy. So when I found her grandchildren, her children were gone. She was 49 in 1952. But I did find her grandchildren and had a very interesting conversation with them. I did not feel any hostility towards them. I couldn't even raise much hostility towards her when I was researching and writing the book, because I viewed her as someone who was just being paid a job that she was being paid for. She wasn't an ideologue. She wasn't one of the commie-hunting congressmen, the people in power. I always try to look at who has the real power and lay the blame or the decision-making to them.
Was there, in your research, ever a time when you felt uncomfortable? So something that you were like, I don't understand this, or I wish I hadn't found this.
There was one. You know, I got all of my father's FBI records, and I was reading through it. They'd investigated my father when he wanted to be an officer. The Army military intelligence went to Detroit and Ann Arbor and interviewed people from his past. And one of the people they interviewed was the student at the University of Michigan who had succeeded my father as the editorial editor of the newspaper. So I'm looking through it and I see this, and his name is Morton Mintz.
Oh, yeah.
And Morton Mintz was a colleague of mine at the Washington Post. I was once his editor for a few years when I was the deputy editor of the investigative staff. And I knew Morton Mintz as a maverick, cantankerous, incredibly dogged investigative reporter who didn't believe anything that any institutional spokesperson would ever say. And here I found Morton Mintz being interviewed by the military intelligence people and telling them that my father was not to be trusted, that he shouldn't be an officer, that he had followed the Stalinist line at the University of Michigan. I was floored. And it turns out that Morton Mintz was still alive when I got this report. He was 95 years old. I was in Madison at the time, and he was in D.C., so I sent him an email saying, Dear Mort, I've got a very difficult subject to talk to you about. I know that you believe in the search for truth, and you've handled a lot of tough things in your life. And then I sent him a copy of his statement to the military intelligence people. And he wrote back the next day and said, Dear David, you know, I don't remember all the details, and I'm ashamed that it ever happened.
Wow.
I wanted to tell him, I don't hold this against you. Again, like Berenice Baldwin, my father was a forgiving man. He understood the difficulties of that time and probably would have forgiven Mort. I don't think my father ever knew this happened. So I didn't want Mort Mintz at age 95 to go to his grave, you know, holding this as his major regret. But yeah, that stunned me.
Wow, that's incredible. Are there things we can learn about the people
at that time who got caught up in the paranoia and the hatred? Are there things we can learn and see today that echo it?
You know, I started this book 1 month before Donald Trump rode the escalator down to announce that he was running for president. So it wasn't inspired by this era, although I see the echoes constantly through American history of the central question of what does it mean to be an American? Who decides? Who is American? You know, today you see the questions of are Muslims really Americans? Are Latinos really Americans? All of those questions echo through American history, starting with the real Americans, the Native Americans. You know, this is part of American history, and it's a difficult part of American history to deal with what it means to be an American.
Yeah, it seems like periodically we get into these obsessions, you know, what is a good American, a good German?
Yeah.
Who should be let in? Who should be right. sent away? On both sides, on the left and the right.
Some parts of the left have great difficulty with freedom of speech, which I believe in as a journalist, of letting 1,000 flowers bloom and not being so uptight about people that you disagree with. That part of the left I've always had problems with, but they haven't had the power. And that's come largely from the right wing determining who they consider to be American. I think that's the central problem. My belief in freedom of speech and freedom of the press has never been stronger than it is today, and I don't think that it's ever been threatened more.
David Marinus is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His most recent book is A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father. And he was talking with Shannon Henry Kleiber. And that's it for this hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Shannon put this hour together with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, and Angelo Bautista. Joe Hartke is our technical director and sound designer. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strangehamps. Thanks for listening.